Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care, working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Wednesday, join us as we explore heart health and homeopathy, a show co-hosted by Homeopathy World Community founder and homeopath, Debbie Bruck, with Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Let's go.
Welcome, everyone, to Blog Talk Radio. We're going to be talking with Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim today. And as soon as he gets on the line and he's here, we're going to get going right away. We have a lot.
Hi.
Hello. It's lovely to speak with you today.
Exactly. Last time I was quite dejected and sullen. Because technology beat me, because I was waiting for 2 hours to get online, and it was never destined to be happening, because my BlackBerry also, the server was down, and the net was down, and both my laptop as well as, nothing was working. So
it was the region. It was for everybody, not just you.
Okay. So anyway, but I'm here back again, and last time's topic, breast masses, continues or other starts?
Right. We had a caller who was very interested in this subject, and you wanted to dedicate an entire show to this important topic.
Yeah. Unfortunately, last time I prepared my mom also, and she was sitting beside me because it's basically her topic, not mine.
Oh.
But I don't know. Something somehow did not work out.
There must be a reason. Somebody is going to come on the show today who needs to hear this message, and that's why. We'll find a positive way to look at it. And sending good wishes to your mom and to you for being here today. Were you going to speak about Stuart Close as well?
Yeah. Actually, two stalwarts. The tribute needs to be paid. One is Dr. William Borick.
Okay.
Dr. William Borick was born on 26th of November, 1849, and he left this world on 1st of April, 1929. So, it is his birth year also, the birth month also, and today is 28th, so 2 days only. So, actually, I was going to pay tributes to Stuart Close, because on 14th, his birthday was there. Well, William Borick was born in Austria on the 26th of November, as I already stated, 1849. And when he was a child, he went to U.S. and settled then in Ohio. In 1880, he attended the medical school and graduated from Hahnemann Medical College in Philadelphia. In 1870, he went to California to manage the Borick and Tafel Pharmacy in San Francisco. Have you been there, Debbie?
No, I have not been there. No, that's on the West Coast, and I don't live on the West Coast. And I don't
actually,
travel.
I had gone to SFO, San Francisco, before coming to LA, Rodendo Bridge Liga. But somehow we missed the Borick and Tafel Pharmacy there. Anyway, so he set up a successful practice in San Francisco, and he was one of the founders of the Homeopathic Medical College of San Francisco. He wrote Borick's Materia Medica, which is quite famous, and the book, which is kept on every homeopathic practitioner's table, in 1901. My God, it's 12 years now. The book went through 9 editions in his lifetime. Oscar Borick's brother and a graduate of Hahnemann Medical College added a repertory to the book in 1906. Borick served in the faculty of Hahnemann Medical College in San Francisco and worked as an editor for The California Homeopath. I doubt The California Homeopath still is there. Is it? I mean, I'm not aware whether they still print out editions. The California Homeopath was a well-renowned journal of his time in the early 1900s.
We will have to investigate and find out the answer to that question.
Yeah. So he served as a faculty of Hahnemann Medical College in San Francisco and editor for California Homeopath. His son, Garth Wilkinson Borick, followed his footsteps and became a homeopath too. Jean Barnard, his granddaughter, recalls, "He used to call us kids Dunn, and he would always kiss and hug us. He was a very loving man." And she further says, "Our family belonged to the high society in San Francisco at that time because Granddad was a physician of choice in the area between 1880 and 1920. People came from all over the world to be treated homeopathically by him. My parents used to say, 'Poor Papa,' because he worked so hard. And the thing I remember the most in them saying, 'Don't bother Papa.' My family was very devoted to him. Whatever he said was the law. Although he emigrated from Austria, he had no accent and there was no German spoken in the house. He and I used to go on walks together down Tamalpais Avenue. I remember he took such long steps. I would scurry along next to him as he engaged me in conversation." So these were his granddaughter's words, Jean Barnard. Well, Borick died on 1st April 1929 due to a heart attack. Again, his granddaughter recalls, "Many months before, he had developed angina after racing my father down Tamalpais Avenue. He was 5'9" and fairly fast on his feet for a man in his late 70s. Borick's house caught fire 2 months after his death, and everything was turned to ash except all of his homeopathic books and the stone fireplace." So, with these words, I pay my tributes to Dr. William Borick.
Thank you very much. And everybody does have his Materia Medica on their shelf. Absolutely. Mine is well-worn, falling apart.
Same has happened with us. For generations together, we have been following Borick's Materia Medica. And another stalwart, since Borick has written wonderful Materia Medica as well as repertory and as an edition. And here we have a philosopher by the name of Dr. Stuart M. Close. This gentleman was born on 14th November 1860 and he died on 26th May 1929. Well, before converting to homeopathy, Close was interested to study law. Like Boninghausen, he was a lawyer, and he was close when he was 19 years old. Close's father died, and after his father's death, his mother remarried a homeopathic physician. Close studied Organon with his stepfather. He attended the medical school in California for 2 years and completed his graduation from New York Homeopathic Medical College in 1885. My God, from West Coast to East Coast. Close worked with P.P. Wells and Bernhard Finck after finishing the school, and he set up his practice in Brooklyn, New York. Close was the founder of Brooklyn Homeopathic Union. Again, is it still there? Do you have any idea? Brooklyn
No.
Homeopathic Union?
I don't know about that. I will have to ask the National Center for Homeopathy and find out. I don't think that they probably organized to with the National Center. And
yeah, they
I don't know that they have a local group.
All these small societies would have merged together and formed a bigger society. I believe that's so. A group devoted to the study of principles of pure Hahnemannian homeopathy. He founded this union in the year 1897. In 1905, Close was elected as president of the International Hahnemannian Association. He was a professor of homeopathic philosophy at New York Homeopathic Medical College from 1909 to 1913. Initially, his lectures were published in the Homeopathic Recorder. Later, these lectures were compiled and published in the form of a book, The Genius of Homeopathy. Again, like Borick's Materia Medica and Repertory, Genius of Homeopathy by Stuart Close is practically on every serious homeopath's desk. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. It is one of the most condensed books on homeopathic philosophy. Close had one of the finest homeopathic libraries in the country. According to Julia M. Green, MD, Close did not know himself. I don't know why did she say this. Close did not know himself. He seemed to wear a gentle armor of protection and look out on the world from behind it. Well, these are her words. Nonetheless, the writings of this great stalwart, the genius of homeopathy, stays close to us, and day in and day out, whenever we read homeopathic philosophy, we definitely refer to Close. And these two gentlemen, Borik and Close, do deserve a tribute on this day.
Thank you.
Before pushing on to the main topic today, that is breast masses, I would go on to two or three good questions. They are both of these gentlemen have studied from California, and I have the first question from William Artsmiller from California, USA, and he says, "Sir, I was reading the second revised edition of Lotus Materia Medica by Robin Murphy. In the chapter of homeopathic medicine and practice, the author has penned that there are five major miasms: cancer miasm, psychosis miasm, syphilis miasm, tuberculosis miasm, and psora miasm, in that order. Kindly give your comments." Quite a good question he's asked, because according to the Organon, there are only three basic chronic miasms: psora, psychotic, and syphilitic miasms. It is not psychosis and syphilis. It is psora, psychotic, and syphilitic miasms. Tubercular miasm, and not tuberculosis, because the latter is a nosological term for disease. Tubercular miasm is a blended miasm. It is either psora plus psychosis, psora plus syphilis, or psoropsychosyphilis, syphilitic miasm. So several new miasms like cancer miasm or amoebic miasms have been coined, but the source of such literature and such miasms is not authentic. Hence, in routine clinical practice or routine homeopathic literature, we do not refer to such miasms as cancer miasm or amoebic miasm, although they are penned. But since the authority, there is no authentic literature available, we don't frequently refer to those miasms. The second question is from Dr. Yusuf Ahmad from Kota Kinabalu, Malaysia. And he says, "In Kent's repertory, in the chapter of stool, it is written white, milk-like, chyle-like. So he asks, which condition does the above occur? Have you ever seen such a patient?" Well, you have a great study of Kent's repertory, Dr. Yusuf, I should say. Yes, it is not uncommon to find patients who complain of passing stools that are milky white in color. In fact, 2 days ago, I had a patient who still passes milky white stools and milky white urine also. And there are several remedies like Calcarea carbonicum, Chelidonium, China, Digitalis, Merxol, Podophyllum, etc. These are listed for the condition that is, these produce white, milk-like, chyle-like stools. But as you are asking, which condition does the above occur? So patients suffering from acute and chronic pancreatitis, very, very common to find such chyle-like stools. Carcinoma of the head of the pancreas, again, these people do manifest, apart from the other symptoms, they pass white, pasty stools. So it is not uncommon that you get such cases. If you have got good number of patients of pancreatitis, particularly acute pancreatitis patients, or carcinoma of the head of the pancreas, then you can come across such a symptom. And the third question, it's the last question of today, and that is asked by Dr. Sharma from Mumbai. I don't know, his first name is not written. Dr. Sharma from Mumbai, and he says, "Sir, many patients ask us to what should be the frequency of exercise for cardiovascular benefit. So then what should be our advice to them?" Well, many patients and of course many doctors take exercise for granted. And if one is suffering from cardiovascular disease, particularly ischemic heart disease or hypertension, then whatever one thinks fit as an exercise, one does. But I believe that is wrong, because American Society of Cardiology and European Cardiology Society and many other societies, particularly these two, Canadian Cardiology Society, these three are prominent, and they have carried out innumerable studies on exercise and heart. And they have devised protocols, they have devised plans, exercise schedules to be followed by cardiovascular patients or patients suffering from cardiovascular diseases. And why these protocols have been designed? So that one derives maximum benefit out of those exercises. The frequency of exercise depends upon the need and the functional capacity of the individual. Any exercise. I mean, first of all, why do I want that exercise? A, just to remain healthy, to keep fit, or C, I want something addition. Apart from keeping fit, I have to exercise a particular organ, say for the heart, say the heart, or any other. Unfit individuals shall benefit most from short duration, frequent exercises. I repeat, people who are not fit for doing exercises, they shall benefit most from short duration and frequent exercises, that is about 2 times a day for about 10 minutes. To others, 10 minutes would be ridiculous, but then when you have a heart patient and he or she wants to start with an exercise, it is always better to ask him or her to start for only 10 minutes for a month, twice a day, and then reassess. For average individuals, the regular exercises for 4 times a week at 80% of maximum heart rate is optimum for condition. Of course, throughout the world, we don't go to cardiologists for our exercise schedule, but then we should. Once you are diagnosed a case of heart disease, then it is the duty of the doctor, your concerning physician, even a concerned homeopath, he or she should advise you what sort of exercise, and that can be done after you go through a test which is called as treadmill test. So depending upon your treadmill, one designs an exercise protocol for you. For those people who are overweight or obese and trying to lose weight, then exercising for 6 times a week for at least 30 minutes is beneficial. Now many people say what sort of exercise. Many people believe that walking is the best exercise or jogging is the best exercise. Well, so there are different norms. Now again, it's a lengthy topic, I should say, but I would like to take up this issue also because this is a very practical issue and many clinicians and many patients would like to know about which sort of exercises should one do and what is the actual benefit for what patients. But then this is out of the purview for question for today. I think this suffices that, people should first ask. People ask about the diet, but the people should also ask about exercise, particularly cardiovascular disease patients should ask about the exercise, what sort of and how much exercise one is able to do is highly individualized.
They're very intertwined and a necessity. We just had a show with Sergei Butenko, who cured a young man yesterday. What is it? Today is Wednesday. So Tuesday was his birthday. He turned 28 years old, and he was diagnosed with juvenile diabetes at the age of 9. The doctors all told him that he needed to take insulin shots and be on medication for the rest of his life. His mother decided that she wanted to investigate other ways of dealing with this illness, and she ended up finding diet and exercise, and he was saying how strenuous he had to exercise twice a day vigorously, no matter what, even if he was exhausted, he had to get his exercise, and he maintained, he actually is not diabetic anymore. And
that's a great news, and it's actually an inspiration for many other IDDMs or insulin-dependent diabetics, because it is actually a norm or rather law that IDDM patients should be on insulin for their life. And if this can be a case, it should not be discarded as an exclusion. It should be, we should take inspiration and definitely investigate. It's really, really interesting to note.
Yes, and he's can be found on the internet all about eating wild edibles, about drinking smoothies, the green drinks, a good vegetarian diet. You can experiment with your own diet, but he found that doing this plus the vigorous exercise was one of the most important things of all to get the organs to get into gear and function properly. That he found, like at night, let's say he couldn't sleep or he was urinating a lot, that once he did the exercise, everything settled out. So, and we also know that diabetes and obesity are intertwined, and the connection is so close that all of the information you're giving us about exercise is very, very important, and people need to get into some kind of a routine.
Exactly. Now, this I've heard about, the exercises curing, or for that matter, taking care of diabetes type 2, that is non-insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus. But I believe Mr. Sergei was suffering from insulin-dependent diabetes. Is it right?
That's right. He did have well, I don't know whether it was heredity, but it was...
It's an autoimmune disease. I mean, it's an autoimmune disease.
It was
you may have a heredity factor or you may not have.
That's right.
So it's really fantastic. And I have at least 9 cases with me of IDDM, but still on insulin, in spite of asking them to exercise and the proper diet, that is blood group diet. Yet, I could have, and with homeopathy, I have decreased the quantum of insulin. The units of insulin that they're taking, they have decreased, but I'm unable to stop the insulin. If I can get hold of this gentleman's, email or so something, I can ask him, and why not try it out in Indian patients and possibly publish a study? It's really good. I mean, any time it is better, instead of insulin, pokes. I would rather prefer having them on a good vegetable diet and heavy exercises, whatever it may be.
Right. So basically, it's up to the individual to monitor and be strict with themselves and find, do what they're told. Because people have a tendency to sneak or be lax or think, like my dad, he knew that he was taking pills. So if he took pills, he said, okay, he can eat whatever he wants. That's not going to be the way. The pill is not going to be the solution. The solution is within each person to be
the
able.
The pill was never a solution.
I know, but he's no longer with us. But
on the other hand, my dad was detected to have diabetes. I remember on September it was 2009. We had a workshop on homeopathy in cardiology at Shimla. Shimla is a very beautiful place in a hill station in India. And not many people around there. We don't find many homeopaths there. So it was the first time that entire family, my mom and dad and my family, all of us had gone to Shimla. And we had expected an audience of about, 60 homeopaths to hear us. And we had kept a workshop for 2 days on homeopathy in cardiology. But it so happened that we had an audience of about 300 people. And the chief minister of the state came to inaugurate that session. And it was a wonderful session. So we stayed there for 10 days. And after coming back to our place, he suddenly started feeling, his appetite became so voracious. So we just tested his blood sugar, and the random blood sugar came down to 490 milligrams. So we were astounded. How suddenly? And he's a very, very disciplined, methodical person. We retested again in another lab. Again, the same values came. And that was on 18th of September. And on 26th of September, his creatinine came to 2.9. And that was alarming. I mean, there was no reason why you should get your kidneys failed. So then he took one dose of sulfur. He was weighing 96 kilograms at that time. He started blood group diet. Reduced 26 kgs in 4 months, strict exercise, and from then onwards, he has never been on any drugs, any pills, and he's off diabetes also. So, we do have a family history of diabetes. It's there. But then, was it sulfur? I don't believe only it's sulfur. It was his strict exercise schedule that could get rid of the entire diabetes. Now, it's 3 years now. He's off all drugs. He's never taken a drug.
This is the problem with our societies around the world today. Those who are connected, like myself, to the computer, and we're sitting all day long, they have very strong connection between just inactivity and non-movement. And our physical bodies are meant to move. We must get active and do the weightlifting or go out for walks and really get the heart going a little bit and do some breath work, whatever it is. But we've got to move our bodies in order to get all of the organs in our body functioning in rhythm.
Yeah, exactly. What happens is, the diet pattern which we are following for generations together, all countries, the diet which my grandfather used to take, I'm following the same dietary schedule. Breakfast, lunch, dinner, probably the same quantum. But my granddad used to go on farms and used to actually toil. Physical labor was there. As far as me, my diet is intact, the same amount, but hardly any physical exercise. So I normally make my patients realize, I tell them to fast. I always tell them to fast one day a week. It's so relaxing to the stomach and the abdomen, and it rejuvenates your entire system. The second thing which I always ask my patients to do is donate blood. Blood donation is a very, very good thing. And actually, yesterday I was donating blood, and we had 100 donors in a small, small village about 100 kilometers from our place. And I was so happy that I could convince the villagers. I mean, I had so many queries. Doc, we are going, as it is, we are very weak. We don't hardly eat so much, and still you want to take our blood. I said, I don't want to take your blood. You have to voluntarily donate. And the benefits of blood donation, it decreases your cholesterol level. It decreases your fatigue. And so many diseases are decreased by blood donation. People don't realize that. So physical labor, a good exercise, and I believe at least on a birthday, one should donate blood. If you are able to donate blood, you should do that.
Thank you. Yes. I know we have a big talk coming up about, I'm ready to hear, and I'm sure that the folks who have come to listen want to hear about it.
Yeah, and that is really the breast masses. We have broadened the topic. Initially, I was only going to take repertory and breast masses, and then I came down to cancer of the breast, but now I'm taking breast masses as a whole. Of course, repertory will be discussed at the end of the topic. And it's a very, very important topic. But before going to that, actually, a listener wanted to hear about this topic. And I was also keen to address this topic because it's quite common. And as of now, we have got around 63 or 64 cases. My mom was giving me the incidence the prevalence of breast cancer cases in our hospital, how many she has, how many are cured and all. So she wanted to speak last time, but today, unfortunately today she is not there beside me. And last time we could not do the show. But she was telling me we have got 63 cases of breast cancer. She's managing, and they are all doing very well. I'm so happy, touch wood.
So are these, your mom is managing these 63 patients with homeopathy?
Yeah, exclusively. She's a homeopathic gynecologist and obstetrician. That is why it's under her purview. And they're quite doing quite very well. And all those 63 are different cases. I mean, some have developed, there's someone in stage 1, stage 2, stage 3. Some have come with metastasis. And I mean, we have got no mortality since past so many years relating to breast cancer. So she was telling me the other day how useful homeopathy can be.
Uh-huh.
As far as breast cancer.
And when she manages these cases, she sees tumor shrinkage. She sees is she just bringing up the level of energy of the person?
No. See, level of energy and all, since we are treating breast cancer patients, we are not only concerned with only increasing the energy. We have got lots and lots of, we are going to discuss how she manages patients at the end of the topic.
Wonderful.
And that's really interesting, and that everyone should learn. It's quite easy to do so. Well, so before going on to breast proper, let me introduce breasts, the organ particularly. It's actually a modified sweat gland. We have got innumerable sweat glands throughout the skin, and breast is one modified sweat gland. It is present in the pectoral region, in the mammals and human body. It is only functional, and rather should be functional only during lactation. It fully develops during puberty, and it's rudimentary in males. Suppose if it is not rudimentary in males, it increases in size, then the term we use medically is called gynecomastia. Gynec means a female, and mastia means breast. Female-like breast in a male is called gynecomastia. In the PPT, if you can see, I have given you two different diagrams showing the anatomy. This mammary gland or breast is basically inside. It consists of complex network of ducts and tubes or channels, what you want to call them. All these tubes or channels are specifically meant to connect the nipple with the gland. And they connect and they deliver the milk out. Then there are lobules. Lobules are actual glands, gland proper, where milk is generated. Then there are breast ducts. surrounding fatty tissues, suspensory ligaments. These ligaments suspend each duct for along with the fatty tissues. Then you have connective tissue fibers, and you have got blood vessels and lymphatics. Now, why do you need to know these? We need to know this because any of these structures, whether they're tubes or lobules or breast ducts or surrounding fatty tissues or suspensory ligaments or connective tissue fibers or blood vessels and lymph glands and lymph nodes, all these, if they enlarge, you can have breast masses.
So it's just we can notice that if those lobules and ducts are internally, we may not be able to feel it with a self-exam, or will we always be able to feel a change? Will we be
so
able to?
Nothing is always. There's nothing as universal, but one should know because many, for example, if there's a mass from arising from a tube or a lobule, then it is likely to be malignant. If it is from a duct and from a fatty tissue or suspensory ligaments, it is likely to be non-malignant. But then that is histologically. Clinically, it is not applicable because clinically we can't come to know where is my breast mass coming from. It is only after you do an FNAC or a biopsy, only then can you come to know. But still, when we are learning about breast masses, it is imperative that we know about the structure of the breast. So it's a simple sweat gland or a modified sweat gland and having lobule, which secretes, instead of sweat, it secretes milk, and the milk is connected to the nipple via the breast ducts as well as tubes and channels. So each breast has got 15 to 20 lobes of glandular tissue, and they are actually arranged like the petals of a daisy. The lobes are divided into smaller lobules that produce milk during pregnancy and breastfeeding. The small ducts, as I said, conduct the milk to the reservoir that lies beneath the nipple. Now, each breast also contains blood vessels, and these vessels carry lymph. These are small bean-shaped organs called the lymph nodes, and we have got the lymph nodes of the breast are situated in the axilla, and that is why if at all there is a lump in the breast and you have got swelling in the axilla, then it is either because of an infection or a cancer, you can come to know that what part of the breast is involved. Because breast is actually cylindrical shape. So we have got four quadrants of the breast. The inner the right upper quadrant and inner upper quadrant, outer upper quadrant, inner lower quadrant and outer lower quadrant. And all these have got different lymph nodes. All are located in the axilla. Now, there are different types of breast masses, but broadly, they are divided into either they can be benign or they can be malignant. And luckily for human beings, 85% are benign, especially in women under 40 years of age. The benign causes of breast lumps are the most frequent cause is the breast infection, or what we normally refer to is breast abscess. Then, another very, very common disease is called fibrocystic disease of the breast, or in routine, I mean, daily language, people can call it lumpy masses. They are huge, big lumps you get every time you are menstruating. Then another common breast mass which you get is a fibroadenoma. Fibro means arising from the fibrous tissue. Adenoma means arising from the gland. So a mass which is arising from the fiber as well as the gland together is called as a fibroadenoma. And we are going to discuss about that. And last is fat necrosis. It is necrosis means degeneration or destruction of that particular cell. So as we all know that breast has got a large amount of fat, and that fat, if it undergoes necrosis, then it presents in the form of a lump. It's a very labile and a soft lump, but then nonetheless it's a lump. Then the next slide which I have given are the X-ray manifestations or the X-ray readings of a phyllodes tumor or a calcified oil cyst or a fibroadenolipoma. All these seem a very, very big words, but then one very important picture is of breast cancer, which you can see. Now, let us first discuss about cancer breast and which people and who are actually predisposed to cancer breast. Number one is those females or even males who have a strong family history of breast cancer. They are first to be predisposed to have cancer breast. I don't know how many percentage. I mean, I can't say whether 70% or 80% of hereditary can cause breast cancer, but yes, a significantly high percentage of patients do respond. I mean, have if they have blood relations of breast cancer, then they do also get breast cancer. And we have three cancers I've seen. One is leukemias, second is breast cancer, and third is cancer of the brain. These have got a very, very strong preponderant hereditary tendency. Second is, if there is an ailment from humiliation or indignation. Now, people from modern medicine would laugh at this. But as homeopaths, as practitioners of energy medicine, it is very, very important that we take the mind into consideration. Because for homeopaths, body is a vehicle of mind. And if your mind has been given a shock, like from humiliation or from indignation, it can manifest. And we have got so many cases to prove this. Rather, if we have an authentic symptom available, if authentic event available, that doc, such thing has happened to me about a year ago, and since then I have been having pain in the breast, or I have been seeing a mass in the breast, and then we can base our remedies like Staphylococcus aureus, like conium, like many other remedies, on only this symptom of ailment from humiliation and indignation. Then, one of the very important predispositions is stress. Now, the stress can be a variety of stress. It can be from the job, from the family, from the environment. I can't go into that. Trauma. Just now, I mean, hardly about half an hour back, a gentleman came to me. He is 36 years old male. And he came to me with symptom of pain in the eye. Only in the right eye he has got pain since 5 years. And he said, "Doc, once I was hit by a small, while driving, I was hit by a small particle, some foreign body. And then it was cleaned by the optician. And from since then, I have got pain in the eye." I said, "Fine." Of course, it does not relate to breast masses, but a very interesting case. I should like to cite this. So, I said, "Okay, then go on." He said that for 5 years, I've been showing to various ophthalmologists, various eye specialists, and all are saying that your eye is completely normal. You don't even require spectacles. Then why do I get pain? I said, "Okay, is the pain continuous?" He said, "No. I get when I strain the eye." I said, "Only one eye?" Yeah, he said, "Yes. Only the right eye. The left eye is completely normal." I said, "Fine, that's wonderful." I said, "Then have you ever been diagnosed with something?" He said, "No, no one has diagnosed with me anything, and they all say that you are psychological." I said, "Fine." I diagnosed him to be migraine. He said, "Migraine?" I said, "Yeah, this is classical migraine. You have got ophthalmoplegic migraine. You don't have headache, but you have got eye pain." Because along with eye pain, he started having nausea. I said, "Fine." Now, I said, then I went on to history. I said, "What is the cause of eye pain? Do you have some stress?" He said, "No, I don't have job stress, family stress, environmental stress." I said, "That's not possible." Then, I asked him about his family life, and I said, "Then I'm unmarried." I said, "Fine. Have you ever had sexual contacts?" He said, "No." I said, "You still do have urge?" He said, "Yes, very much." 36 years old male, unmarried, has not had sexual contacts, and this is called as sexual repression. I only had to ask this, and the remedy selected was conium. A wonderful remedy for the eye and a remedy for sexual repression. And I'm very sure that when he comes back after 15 days or a month, he is going to report significant improvement in the eye complaint.
Debbie, are you there?
Yes, I am here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, very well.
Yeah, very good story. You have any more stories?
Yeah. I mean, this case, although this was the last case which had come to me just before our interview started, so I wanted to say, since we were talking about stress and trauma, sorry. So, for cancer breast, we have got trauma, and we have got specific medicine from ailments after trauma. Breast cancer occurring from because after trauma, there is specific medicine, Belispar, and it really works. Then we have got specific Rupric also.
I'm sorry.
Belispar.
Is this in the handout?
Yeah, it is there in that PowerPoint presentation.
Okay.
Yeah, it's there. So, specific remedy for trauma, breast, and leading to cancer, it is Belispar. And hematoma is another rubric on page number 881 of Ken's repertory, where other remedies also given. Suppose if a female has undergone, for either medical or cosmetic reasons, surgery or excision of benign tumor, then she is quite predisposed for developing cancer also. Again, this point is debatable as far as surgeons are concerned, because they fail to accept that repeated biopsies or repeated FNACs can cause cancer. It can instigate cancer. But it is our clinical observation since a long, long time, particularly homeopaths from this part of the world, and we have seen that any meddling, any surgical meddling with the masses, breast masses, it instigates malignant change or neoplastic change.
I was concerned about that, because you mentioned earlier that the diagnosis was dependent upon a biopsy or a needle biopsy or something. And once you do this, are you not starting another kind of stress?
Yeah, that is why homeopaths diagnose the case clinically rather than depending upon histopathologically. Pathological diagnosis, we don't, because if we do that, the only investigation I would suggest is a mammography or a sonomammography, because it's a non-invasive diagnosis, investigating modality. But FNAC and biopsy, I mean, they are, and they do charge up the entire breast and they bring out malignancy. We have seen innumerable cases. It's worthless to fight upon this hypothesis, what you call, because we have seen it clinically and we have affirmed it. And our remedies are based upon that, because we have got remedies like arnica, like natrum sulf, and many others, which bring out malignant change after this surgery or excision for her benign tumor. But unfortunately, I've discussed this with many other allopathic colleagues, and they don't seem to agree with me. But nonetheless, this is our homeopathic clinical observation, and we are fine with it.
Can I interject one other?
Yeah.
We have this week a huge article from the NEJM, the
New England Journal of Medicine,
about the effect of 3 decades of screening mammography on breast cancer incidence. I'm sure you must have seen this. And basically, we have millions of women who were given an early diagnosis of cancer, went through the traditional surgery, chemo, radiation, and they really did not have an active case of cancer at all. It could have been something that have maybe just gone away on its own, or with proper nutritional diet and exercise and homeopathic remedies or mother tinctures, whatever, could have been perfectly fine. It could have been just an expression of, as you say, the change in hormones that women have throughout the month. But it's such an aggressive form of detection and treatment that many women's lives have been tremendously effective, the whole family financially, emotionally, you know, just to get the diagnosis in itself is a tremendous shock on the system. So people who want to see that, there's a lot of information. I can put a link to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've gone through this article, but I don't remember exactly the contents. But nonetheless, reverting back to our predisposition is infertility. Many females were married or marry very late and are infertile.
they are very much prone to breast cancer. Likewise, exactly opposite, multi-para females, grand multi-para who are reproducing 10 children, 12 children, 14 children, quite common in earlier years of India. I mean, my grandmother had got 10 children, her sister had got 21 children. I mean, hats off to them. But still, because of loss of vital fluids, I don't know what, but they are quite predisposed to cancer of the breast. Repeated mastitis. Every time you deliver a child, you get mastitis. And then you are predisposed. Vaccination, another very, very important triggering factor, a predisposing factor. And time in and time again, we have been discussing about vaccination and its ill effects. And vaccination instigating malignancy is quite well known. Whether people agree or disagree, that's totally a different question about it. Then, again, people who have already got cancer of the cervix or the cancer of the endometrium, these are very much prone for cancer of the breast, particularly after hysterectomy or removal of the cervix or the endometrium. If we have also seen, at a center, if girls have got early onset of menstrual cycle, that is called premature menarche, or a very late menopause, now these females are also more prone for breast cancer. And if the first pregnancy is at a very old age, more than 34, 35, 36 years of age, then the female has got a greater chance of cancer of the breast.
Repeat that one more time. The woman at old age what?
First pregnancy at the old age.
Oh, first pregnancy at old age.
Yeah. Particularly at 34, 35, 36 years of age, if the female delivers, then the chances of breast cancer increases tremendously. So, these females are predisposed. But then, just being predisposed does not bring on cancer. For cancer, for that matter, any disease, you have to have an exciting factor, a triggering factor. And that triggering factor is generally mental, generally an acute stress, generally a shock, either physical or mental, generally post-mechanical intervention. So, that is our experience, and every time, whenever we get a case, I first ask and confirm the exciting factor. If I have an exciting factor at hand, a sure shot exciting factor, my remedy selection becomes very easy. Management of the case becomes very easy. But then, like a candle, which is lighted candle, you require a matchstick to light a candle, so that is an exciting factor. But then you require the wax for the candle to burn. And that wax, in medical terminology, for any disease, we call them as maintaining factors. So you require a predisposing factor to get any disease. Then you require an exciting factor to start the disease. And you require a maintaining factor to continue the disease. And the maintaining factor, most commonly, are suppressions. Either emotional suppressions, suppressions of sexual desire, as the case which I just mentioned, that gentleman gave out in the form of migraine, an ophthalmoplegic migraine, because he had repressed or suppressed his sexual desire for a long time. So, even cancer breast is quite very well known. Repression or suppression of emotions, ambitions and desires are very important maintaining factors. And of course, if you don't have the miasm, that is the
sauropsychotic. What if somebody takes a vow, of celibacy? Is there found a high rate of cancers in these people?
I have got three nuns of sea breast.
Uh huh.
Three nuns, one after another. One is 52 years, another is 28 years, and another is 33 years. Three nuns. And they have been coming to us, all these three sisters are coming to us since past now 4 or 5 years.
Okay.
And another, I have got a priest who is suffering from cancer of the breast. He's a male.
Okay.
I mean, he was a brother. I mean, before attaining fatherhood, I mean, he was a brother. So his name is Brother John.
He has got cancer of the breast, right breast. So we have got four people, celibacy, they have taken vows and still suffering from cancer. They don't have any sort of other physical stress and mental stresses. I inquired time and again. This one is it. And all of them coincidentally have received conium at some point of the time. All are doing very well. None of them have undergone surgery. All these four people.
So these are our experiences. Should I go on?
Yes, I was just listening to what you said, and you know, it sounds like you have quite a number of cases coming in, and it would be wonderful to be able to collaborate with other people who are seeing similar data.
Yeah,
similar cases.
When I say I don't see breast cases, breast cancer cases. My mother of the Department of Gynecology and Obstetrics. But then we keep on, every Saturday we have got clinical meeting and they keep on discussing breast cancer cases, and that's why how we come to know.
Okay. Where are we in the
we are on the next, the symptomatology. Now, cancer of the breast, what sort of symptoms would one expect? Number one, it depends upon underlying cause of the lump. The most commonest is a painless lump and rarely a painful lump. And I always say painful lumps are better than painless lumps. Wherever there is pain, pain means reaction. Pain means the body is telling you something, do something. But if it's painless, if the body is not reacting and the pathology is growing inside, that is not a good phenomena or not a good thing. So, painless or painful lump, either it is firm or it may be hard in consistency with regular and irregular borders. I mean, you can actually feel the borders of the lump. It may be irregular, it may be regular, whatever. Then, if your nipple is pulling inwards or you have a swelling of the nipple or undue itching of the nipple, or if the color of the nipple has changed or color of one of the nipple has changed, then one should suspect something bad is inside. Instead of milk, at the proper time, if you have a bloody discharge or a straw colored discharge, then again, we have got a problem at our hand. Skin over the breast. If there are the skin changes of the breast, either dimpling or orange peel colored skin or undue redness or visible veins. Initially, if the veins are not visible, but you now see fine visible veins over the skin of the breast, or a new ulcer has developed, all these signify cancer of the breast unless otherwise proved. I repeat, unless otherwise proved. Then if you have got unexplained weight loss, if you are, otherwise your appetite is normal, so everything else is normal, but you are losing significant weight. One of the first diseases we think is diabetes. The second thing, if you don't have a family history of diabetes or no other features of diabetes, then you can have thyroid disorders, anemia, and if not, then yes, a malignancy also needs to be ruled out, and cancer of the breast is no exception. It may not bring any of these things, neither a lump nor a nipple change nor changes on the skin of the breast. It may only manifest as the first symptom as continuous weight loss. And we have seen such patients. Cancer of the breast is known to spread to particular organs, and one of the favorite organs for spread is bone. Breast and bones, both starting with B, and so CA of the breast does spread other than its own nodes to the bones. And if you have a persistent bony pain, then one should investigate, one should think of some malignancy, if not breast cancer, then some malignancy. If the bone is near to the breast, then one can think of breast malignancy also. So these are the few symptoms one should think of in cancer breast. Now, there are several age-dependent lumps. Different ages, you get different types of lumps. For example, if newborn infants, and when I say newborn, we are talking about babies born till 48 to 96 hours.
if they've got, they basically have enlarged breast tissues beneath the nipples. It is stimulated by mother's hormone. But then nothing to worry about. These disappear within few months of birth, and they are not at all malignant, and they are not there to stay. They disappear on their own. Nothing has to be done about it. So many females, children of both gender, newborn children of both genders, can get enlarged breast tissues. Again, beginning at the early age of 8 years, girls may develop tender lumps beneath one or both nipples. Now, these lumps are called breast buds and are one of the earliest signs of the beginning of puberty. Now, if this develops by the age of 5 years, or 4 years, or 6 years, then we call it as premature puberty. And one of the classical drugs which we give, administer, is Medoranum. Medoranum is a drug for premature puberty. You get lots of, you can prevent, by giving Medoranum at this stage, you can really prevent, if this girl has family history of malignancy, particularly breast cancer, then you can prevent it right away by giving Medoranum. It is the remedy for premature puberty or premature menarche. So these lumps are breast buds and one of the earliest signs of the beginning of puberty. Hormonal changes just prior to menstruation may give a lumpy or glandular feeling of the breast tissues. And for such symptoms, I mean, a lumpy or granular feeling to the breast tissues, we have a specific drug which is Bryonia. The breasts feel heavy during each menses, and that is Bryonia. We have also got Kali Carbonicum. These two are remedies for breast lumps only during menstruation. Or if not lumps, a lumpy or granular feeling to the breast tissues.
We have somebody calling in. Hold on a second. Hello, we have a caller.
I didn't press one. Are you talking to me?
Yes, we don't have to press one when we're on Blog Talk. Just go ahead and either give your comment or ask your question of Dr. Adel.
I wanted to know what remedies are generally used and how you distinguish for suspicious lumps discovered through ultrasound or MRI in older people over 60.
I'm wondering if she just got onto the talk because we have been discussing.
I did.
Yeah.
Yes, because I'm on the West Coast and I didn't get the email about the thing until now.
Okay. I encourage you to listen to the archive of the show when it's over, but also I'm sure Dr. Otto will address your question.
Going to address this. We are going to talk about this same very question just now in the next coming slides.
Okay, great.
So,
in the next
since we talk about breast masses, how do we investigate such cases? Throughout the world, we have got hemogram. Hemogram means all the blood investigations that include the leukocyte count, the blood counts, whether is it malignancy or is it more of an infectious origin, a hemogram will show you. Ultrasonography of the breast, a very, very good imaging modality, and you can pick up malignant masses or benign masses from breast USG. Breast biopsy is there, and fine needle aspiration cytology or FNAC in short are there. But as homeopaths, we do not advocate them. We go on for either breast USG or a mammogram or a sonomammogram, and if required, a MRI. So all these are investigations. Now, many people working on breast masses and breast this would give us various studies, and like this New England Journal study and lots more, debating that every mass should be biopsied or every mass should have got FNAC and all. But then, as homeopaths, we have our principles to follow, and we have got a clinical viable. We don't advocate them unless patients force us to do so. I would not let the patient go in for biopsy. If at all, if I'm suspicious, my clinical suspicion is very strong, then I would remove the entire breast. So instead of going in for biopsy and then waiting and watching and then waiting for the breast to be, whether it's benign or malignant or whatsoever. So hemogram, breast sonography, sonomammogram, MRI are good enough for me. Should we go on for breast abscess or directly go on for malignancy? What do you think, Debbie?
I think that the order of your slides, do you have abscess next?
Yeah, we have got abscess next, and then we have got fibroadenoma, and then we are shifting on to malignancy. But then if we do that, we'll be, I think we go on for malignancy and then discuss abscess and fibroadenoma in the next session.
Sounds
Let us complete
good.
The press.
Very good.
So,
talking about more about cancer breast properly, it is as everyone knows, is the second leading cause of cancer deaths in women. It can also occur in men. The cells divide more rapidly than healthy cells, and they may metastasize, that means may spread through the breast to the lymph nodes and other parts of the body. There are two major types of breast cancer. Ductal cancer, ducts are those channels which conduct the milk from the gland to the nipple. So you can have a cancer in those ducts, which is called ductal carcinoma. And you can have a lobular carcinoma. Lobes are the glands, actual glands which manufacture milk, and you can have a cancer in that. And that is called adenocarcinoma. It starts in the lobule that produces milk. So two major types, ductal cancer and lobular cancer. I have given you a picture of that. What are the signs and symptoms? Again, I repeat, a painless lump. Again, it is painless, not painful. When we are talking about cancer, it is painlessness, which is important. A painless lump or thickening in the breast. Or you can have a spontaneous clear or a bloody discharge from the nipple associated with the breast lump, or it may not be associated with the breast lump. Retraction or indentation of the nipple. Change in the size or the contours of the breast. Any flattening or indentation of the skin over the breast. Either the skin has become flattened, or you can have an indentation or dimpling of the skin over the breast. And redness or pitting of the skin over the breast, like a skin of an orange, what we call as pew the orange appearance, P-E-A-U-D-E, orange. Pew the orange appearance is redness or pitting of the skin over the breast, like the skin of an orange. So these are some of the classical symptoms of cancer of the breast. I repeat again, they may be there, they may not be there. So, but generally they are there. In many, many percentage of females, one of these symptoms are there. Then I have given you another slide for self-breast examination. And the self-breast examination, particularly in families having breast cancer, should start by the age of 20 years in a female and male. And it's very easy. Either you go cylindrical, inside out, or outside in. Whatever you want to do, just examine at least once a month is fair enough. But then there are different photographs showing how to examine, self-breast examination is there. Investigations again, computer-aided detection, digital mammography, MRI and breast ultrasound. Now, finally coming to most important topic for cancer. Suppose if I have a family history of cancer breast, particularly from the mother's side, my grandmother, great-grandmother, my maternal aunts or rarely paternal aunts having breast cancer, then as a preventive, if the female has come to you, has not got cancer of the breast as of now, homeopathy can actually prevent them, and we have been giving such cases. For example, if you have a case of cancer breast, we collect all those relatives of that patient, the blood relatives of the patient, and give them, administer them carcinosin. Carcinosin is a preventive drug. It is like a vaccination which is administered for prevention of malignancy. Of course, we have not published any reports, and neither has anyone, whether carcinosin can authentically and in every case prevent cancer of the breast. But then, it's a long time. We have started this in 1984 and now it's 2012 and nearly 20 years. And thankfully, we have been following all those patients, as many as possible, and to those we have administered carcinosin, year in and year out, we have not seen any evidence of cancer coming in them. So this is a very significant amount of time. So that is why we can say that if you have a case who has got breast cancer and she has relatives, particularly the daughter or sister, who have not got the cancer of the breast, it is advisable to give carcinosin. One more thing. Carcinosin is given in three different potencies. Day 1, 30. Day 2, 200. And day 3, 1 m. Don't ask me why. This we have debated innumerable times at our. Why only carcinosin is the only drug? Why it should be given day 1, 30, day 2, 200, and day 3, 1 m. But then we have already been following this practice, and it seems to be working.
That's very interesting. So is it just one time in the lifetime, or annually, or
no,
every...
No. We give them once in 3 years.
Once in 3 years.
Again, don't ask me why in 3 years. Why not 5 years? So these are all, I mean, clinical practices followed, but they have been paying dividends. Now, the whys need to be answered, but then this is not the time, and I don't know the answer about whys. But yes, carcinosin has proved itself to be a very good preventive for cancer of the breast. Then
very
suppose
good.
Now, which carcinosin to be used? We use generally squamous carcinosin, that is the carcinosin prepared properly from squamous carcinoma of the breast or epithelium of the breast. Because you can have carcinosin being prepared from any other malignancy also. But you have to specify, rather you have to ask that place from where you get carcinosin, from where, which source has been prepared. If not, you can prepare it yourself. I mean, you can get a carcinoma specimen, or a breast carcinoma specimen from a pathology lab, if it's possible, and you can prepare it. You can require only one single drop. So that is carcinosin as a homeopathy prevention CA breast. What about a case who has actually come to you? Well, then you can have curative treatment, you can have cases which are difficult to cure, and you can have cases which are practically incurable. Then what do you do about these cases? Suppose if you have a patient who is in a predisposed state, you know that she has a family history. She also has started developing a growth which is less than 2 cm. It is quite movable. It is tender, that means pain is still there. You don't have constitutional symptoms. And basically her menses are unaltered. So, yes, this lady has a family history. She can have cancer breast. It's yet not established. We have not done a biopsy. We have not done a FNAC. We, in this case, the disease is still in a functional state. And this is the time to give her constitutional remedy. And drugs like calcarea carbonicum, lycopodium, thyroidinum, lachesis, many other, I mean, whichever the constitutional drug, give the constitutional drug, repeat it after 1 month or 2 months as you feel fit, and follow up the patient for a year and then give her carcinosin once you stop the treatment. Then probably this growth can be cured, or the entire cancerous diathesis can be taken care of at one stroke.
So this means that the physician and the patient, with all the anxiety of detecting a tumor, a growth, a mass, they must have extreme patience and instill calm and know that they are taking the proper course of action over an entire year of getting the constitutional remedy, because in most likelihood, if you went to the allopath and the oncologist, they would want to do aggressive treatment right away to prevent further what they would say would be a malignancy.
Yeah, it totally depends upon the, first of all, the faith of homeopath in himself or herself. See, if I have faith in my pathy, if I have faith in myself, then it would be me who can convince the patient very easily. If I'm in my doubts, then it's very difficult to convince the patient. The patient wants relief, whether you give as a homeopath or whether an allopath gives. He or she does not know what a constitutional remedy is. He or she does not know what cancer is. He or she just comes to you to get cured. So it is the art of a homeopath, the confidence of homeopath in himself or herself, how he convinces his or her, her patient to stay for the entire year, for that period of time, not being blind, being very observant to that particular mass, respecting that mass, respecting, treating it as malignancy, even if it is not, and monitoring. I feel sad that it is not, the being overzealous treatment has become the order of the day. Everyone becomes so hyper, so anxious to get that thing removed. They are not seeing it that the body has taken out pathology as a form of its, and it's throwing its miasmatic load via breast. And removing it does not solve the purpose, because the miasm will express it out in some other form, some other site. So, this holistic approach is missing. And that is why you keep on removing masses and do not treat the cancer per se.
Right. And this goes along with what I said earlier about the diagnosis using mammography, which I find is very harmful by giving trauma to the breast tissue with delicate, what you showed us, the anatomy, and not only going, the anxiety that a woman goes through every time they get the mammogram, and then the
squashing, and
the radiation.
Repeated mammography is again harmful. But because we are practitioners and we are legal practitioners, we have to follow some rule of the law. We can't just be absolutely clinically dependent. We have to ask them to do some investigation. And FNA's mammography or sonomammogram, sonology is much better, at least than biopsy or FNAC.
And please, I would like to mention thermography. I did an entire show with the family who designed the thermography, and you can see that on the Health In Show, one of our older shows, and we will have him back again. But with this kind of detection, it's just a photograph, a heat pattern, like infrared light, and it shows the whole breast tissue, the body tissue, and where there is activity going on, it shows it through color. And there's no touching of the breast at all. It's just a digital camera photograph. And
I know. And the red spot is called as a hot spot, and the blue spot is called as a cold spot.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's another thing we don't want to forget as an option for detection.
Yeah, why shouldn't we forget? We should use all available non-invasive items first. Then the second type of cases we have are difficult to cure cases. If your female comes to you with a growth bigger in size, I mean bigger than 2 centimeters, the growth is firm to hard, it's fixed at its place, it's not moving around, and has one or two constitutional symptoms, like, for example, loss of weight or loss of appetite or decrease of thirst, unusual sweating, or something, some physical general has altered. So in this case, the disease is still in the hold of constitution and the body is vital enough to revert the pathology. So we don't give up hope, but then we use some deeper acting drugs like graphitis, like phytolaca, like cystiscan, and administer them a slight more repetition is required than the earlier ones. For example, in the constitutional drugs, we don't repeat them so often. We would repeat them once in 3 months or once in 4 months or once in 9 months. But in this second group, we would repeat graphitis or phytolaca or cystiscan weekly or at the most fortnightly to gain results.
And then
we have got the third group of cases, which are incurable cases. The cases have far advanced pathology. The mass is very stony hard. It's not only hard, it's stony hard. Or we have an ulcer, which is oozing out blood and pus. The mass or the ulcer is fixed. Or you have got proven metastasis in the axillary lymph nodes or in the chest. And we have got gross constitutional symptoms. Again, homeopathy has good amount of role. Here it is where we use drugs like Thuja or iodium or conium or carboenamylase or asterisk rubens, depending upon the symptoms. And still we have seen, even at this stage, we have seen growths regress in size, although saving the patient or may not saving the patient, just improving the quality of life is a highly an individualistic case. So drugs like Thuya or iodinum or conium or carbon amylase or astaxanthin and many more can be used even at this stage, and you can still get results. Now, one more thing which I have not mentioned is there are many cases which have got cancer of the breast. They have undergone radiation. They may have undergone chemotherapy once, twice, and they have come to you after 3 years again with a re-emergence of cancer of the breast. Now, if that lady has got greater amount of mental genitals, for that matter, a significant change in her temperament or a significant change in her appetite, thirst, urine, stool, sexual functions, sweating, then still we may prescribe a constitutional remedy and the growth, the re-emergence of growth can be stopped again. Or if the patient has undergone radiation and wants to come, has opted homeopathy so that she may not have the recurrence again, in this case, the first drug you give is radium brome. If the patient has undergone radiation, the first drug to be given is radium brome. And then, if possible, give her a constitutional remedy. If not possible, then you can safely give carcinosin.
And always, we have to stress that this show, Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community, is a educational, informative talk, a discussion, and you must always see your healthcare provider, your physician, your oncologist, whoever it is that you need, if you need treatment. Don't do it yourself. You need to have an observant caretaker who has the experience and with this type of disease.
Yeah. In the final two slides, I have collected all the rubrics related to breast cancers or breast tumors. The first is tumors, mammary, page 1346 in the Kent Repertory. Then we have got nodule or lumps, page 835 and 838. Ulcer, 882. Swelling, 881. Distension of breast, 829. Induration or hardness, 834. Discoloration of mammary, 829. There is a separate rubric called scirrhus or epithelioma. It's a separate type of cancer of the breast on page number 824. Emaciation of the breast mass, 829. Hypertrophy or enlargement of the breast, 835. Fistulous opening, 832. Then, pertaining to the nipple, you can have aphthia of the nipple. Aphthia has small, small, painful boils around the nipple. They may also turn malignant, page number 823. Or the entire nipple can be destroyed, which is called atrophy of the nipple. Again, a very, very plausible sign of cancer of the breast, page number 824. Bleeding from the nipple, a very common cancer sign, page 824. Cracks in the nipple, again, not a sign. I repeat, not a sign of cancer of the breast. Generally, cracks of the nipple do not signify malignancy. It signifies more an infection. Deformed nipple, yes, malignancy is yes. 828. Discharge from the nipple other than milk, 829, can signify cancer of the breast. But if it is pus, then it signifies breast abscess rather than cancer. Undue dryness of the nipple, again, does not signify cancer, but still it is seen, it can be seen in cancer, page number 829.
Excoriation of the nipple, 831, again a significant sign of cancer of the breast or nipple. And ulcer of the nipple, very well known, it may be malignant, may not be malignant. Then sometimes you need to have rubrics for metastasis, if the cancer is spread to it, particularly cancer of the breast has spread to the axilla. Then you have got specific rubric on page number 824, cancer axilla. There you can also take, when we say axilla, we don't mean axilla, the whole axilla. We are actually meaning the nodes which are residing in the axilla. So if the breast cancer is spread to the nodes, axillary nodes, then you can have the rubric on page number 824. Again, you have got induration, page number 835. Exostosis, that is if the cancer is spread to the bones or the ribs, Then page number 832. Cancer of the sternum is a separate rubric, page number 824. And you've got pain, either the sternal pain or this because of the cancer of the breast. Then it's a separate rubric, page 845. So, I have tried. It's a very, very big subject, and you can have a diploma or 2 or 3 years study exclusively in cancer or the breast masses. But I have foregone the two topics, breast abscess and fibroadenoma, which we'll be discussing in the next session. But I have tried to explain how we manage and how to understand cancer of the breast. If there are any more questions, they are most welcome. If I've missed out on something of cancer breast which is of relevance, please let me know and we will be discussing in the next issue.
Yes, let's encourage people. If you're a listener, let folks know that we have this show. It is on the archives now. Once the show is finished and all of our, we've got probably between 400 and 500 shows on Blog Talk Radio. You can listen to the shows. You can share them by sending the link to your friends via email. You can go to Facebook and find Homeopathy World Community on Facebook and keep in touch with what we're doing there. You can go to Homeopathy World Community and read all of the articles. We have a special group for Dr. Otto's show with the listings of all of the ones that we have done together. You can also, besides Twitter, of course, I love Twitter, get out there and tweet it out to your friends. Any way that you can share these shows is much appreciated. Send us a message. And we also have homeoacad.org is Dr. Otto's website, and he has a input form where you can send him a message directly and ask your questions, and he basically answers them on the air live for anybody who does have a special interest in any area of health. We do get off on talking on anything, whether it is nutrition or exercise, any kind of disease that or concern that people have. We like to talk about it and get it out in the open. I really thank you so, so much for being with us today, Dr. Adil. It's probably getting late over there in India. And I've scheduled another 30 minutes to go with the show, so I'm going to be talking about taking the case. And I've been talking each week from Dr. Herbert Roberts, The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy. This is Chapter 8, and so I'm going to be talking about taking the case. And for all those who wish to continue to listen, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a wonderful time. Back again, of course, unfortunately, last time. Again, I'm very sorry for the listeners who hope to listen to me, but I could not get there because of technological error. Man was first dependent on nature, he still is, but again, very much dependent on technology. Many things we don't understand, we just have to accept them. So, have a very, very great week, and see you next time.
Thank you so much. And I'm going to go ahead and continue. If you missed the show last week, I did talk Chapter 7, and now I'm going to be talking about taking the case. Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD, gives us so much information, and he starts off this chapter by saying to look into the organon on paragraphs 83 to 104, where Dr. Hahnemann explains how to take the case. He says, in taking the case, the homeopathic physician has two objects in view. First, there is the object of diagnosis. This is to place your difficulty in a group class. The homeopathic physician can have no other object in making a diagnosis than to classify the symptoms under a group heading. Since the homeopathic physician never uses his diagnosis for therapeutic purposes, in this he differs from the ordinary school of medicine, which uses the diagnosis as a guide to the desired therapy, certain group conditions determined by the diagnosis determining the therapy to apply. And basically he's talking about nationalized type of medicine where once a diagnosis is made, they've already determined the course of action of what kind of therapy you're due to get. Whereas for a homeopath, we must individualize the therapy based on the symptoms that the patient provides for us through our observation, through our clinical observation, and whatever comes through the technical diagnosis. So it's not one size fits all. Dr. Herbert Roberts says, with the homeopathic physician, the group is never treated as a unit. The individual patient, into whatever diagnostic group he may fall, is treated as an individual. And the therapeutic measures are directed according to the individual symptoms. And you've just heard Dr. Otto explain how he looks at the patient, looks at the emotional, the mental, the causation, the etiology, and puts it into the three types of groups. Is the mass that he sees, is it fixed, is it movable? Are there functional changes, or are there pathological changes? This will help determine the homeopathic remedy that is chosen. He even was able to provide for us the factors of heredity, as in giving carcinosin as a vaccination for an individual in a family who might have a predisposition or be prone to getting a cancer even. So Dr. Herbert Roberts says, therefore, the second and greater object in taking the case is to select the true symptoms of the patient and to clarify them so that we can make a definite picture of the ills of the patient. Many of the things of which we speak when it comes to taking the case may seem very commonplace, but there is nothing in the practice of homeopathy upon which so much depends as the thorough comprehension of the background that we must have in taking the case and getting the case properly before us for analysis. The presentation of the case should include the whole picture. We cannot depend upon our memory in taking the case. The picture must be preserved in indelible form, in a form which we may go over in review without the danger of leaving out any important symptom. We must be able to turn back to any individual symptom or group of symptoms at any time. So, as the first requisite in taking the case, you must have your record cards with you to note down the case as it is taken. So much depends upon the record that you cannot afford not to take the time for properly recording the case. And I want to say here that we've had a series of lectures and talks with Dr. Christina Chambreau, who is a homeopathic veterinarian, and she teaches us that even for our pets, to keep a journal. And from the time that you first get your pet and bring it home, you can see any kind of progression or changes in the behavior of your pet or in any observation of how they relate in the home to other animals and in their physical changes. And then you can go back to this record and see, aha, and say it was when there was lightning, it was when there was a thunderstorm that all of a sudden you saw a change in the behavior of your pet. So this is true for humans too, that keeping a diary is a pretty good thing to do. And you can note any kind of changes in your life, and these records are important. Dr. Roberts says, in making the first prescription, this record is all important. And in making the subsequent prescriptions and in reviewing the case so that the order of disappearance of the symptoms, we cannot move in any degree or assurance unless we have the record in accessible form. So here he's referring back to, I think, two sessions ago, we were in chapter five of his book, that we talked about Herring's Law, and that knowing the direction of cure, knowing that from the vital organs to the outer organs, preserving those, seeing changes in that course of action, knowing that historically back from the present disease symptoms to the historical past disease symptoms, from upper to lower, from inward to outer. These are going to tell us and be the cues to know whether we are finding the correct remedy that's leading toward growth, leading toward development of the cure of the individual, toward a stasis and normal balance in their life. So this is why he says you must know the order of disappearance of the symptoms. The attitude of the physician, he says, should be one of absolute rest and poise, with no preconceived ideas nor prejudices. He should be in a quiet, listening attitude, and as the case is presented to him, he or she should have no previous impressions as to what remedy the patient will require, because this of itself would bias his judgment. And this is a very difficult thing for any homeopath who has taken hundreds, if not thousands, of cases to do, because they have a base of knowledge and experience. As the person walks in, they make observations, they see whether the person is agitated, whether they're sweating, whether they're flushed, what their odor is, what all sorts of things can be detected right away by seeing the patient, by the way that they speak and what they're saying, and also in their gestures, their attire, and how they carry themselves. So Dr. Herbert Roberts is telling us that we must sit back and almost have a clear slate. We have to have a clear mind so that we don't jump to conclusions right away based on the input of information that's already being given without the patient even speaking to us. He says, the first thing to note is the patient's name, age, sex, vocation, and, if possible, avocation, their hobbies. Then we are often greatly helped by getting a record of the family. That is, the age of the parents, their general health, and cause of death if they are deceased. This applies to brothers and sisters also, and we must not neglect to get a picture of the types of ailments from which they have suffered. We often get a good picture of hereditary tendencies in this way. Find out, if possible, if there is or has been blood relationships between ancestors. Consanguinity plays an important part in hereditary tendencies as well as in making your prescription. And here he has in italic parentheses the remedy phosphorus, and maybe this he has found in the books and in his own cases, that when blood relationships have relations, that they might need the remedy phosphorus, or to clear out the case and make it more definite of what the constitutional remedy might be in that case. So he's giving us the basics. This book is geared toward homeopaths, those who are studying homeopathy, those in the medical field who want to learn how to practice homeopathy. And basically you start with getting the name, age, sex, vocation, and avocation. Then the family history. And this is so important because Dr. Otto just taught us that for patients who have a predisposition to cancer, we can find that out by taking the family history. Now we are ready to proceed with the record of the patient, him or herself. Let us begin to record the past illnesses. What illnesses has he or she had? How about his or her recovery from each illness? Particularly note whether he reports himself as fully recovering from the illnesses or whether he says he, quote, has not been well since, unquote, any particular illnesses. And this is really famous in homeopathy, that the never been well since syndrome can give us a cue and a clue to the fact of where the vital force was impacted, and now we might have a number of remedies listed in the repertory in the Materia Medica that says never well since. And was it malaria? Was it since a shock? Was it since a move? Was it since a loss? And all of these can give us indicated remedies. Now, ask the patient to tell you in his own words how he or she became ill and exactly how did he feel. Do not offer any interruption, lest you break his thread of thought. As you record the symptoms, leave space between them so that you can fill in later the answers to the questions as it may be necessary. And here he's talking about how you're noting on your piece of paper all the words, the exact words, verbatim, as the patient is speaking, and leave space to fill in the blanks, those questions you might have in your mind. And just go on with the talk. It's almost like a meditation where you note that you have a question and then you keep going and listen intently. If he or she comes to a point where he seems to hesitate, simply ask this question, what else? Continue the system of interested listening until he seemingly has exhausted his story. So you're getting the full story this way. Then you are ready to review the case as it has been given to you. Perhaps before we go into the next step, says Dr. Roberts, the questioning by the doctor, it will be well to state the things we must never do. We cannot place too much emphasis upon the absolute necessity of leaving these things undone. And here he has listed 5 points. Number one, avoid all leading questions. By leading questions, Dr. Herberts means that questions that suggest answers to the patient. Because, you know, a patient wants to please the doctor. And he or she might just answer in the way he thinks the doctor wants the answer. So he says, questions that suggest answers to the patient or suggest that you want to bring out certain answers. Some patients are desperately anxious to have their answers suggested to them, and the physician must be constantly on his or her guard to avoid doing so. So you don't want to give the answers, put the words into the patient's mouth. You want only what the patient knows, observes, feels in themselves. Number two, never ask direct questions that may be answered with a direct affirmative or negative. That means don't ask any yes or no questions. Number three, never ask alternating questions back and forth. It's sort of like an interrogation. You don't want to do that. Number four, avoid questioning along the line of a remedy. Sometimes we may get a clue from the statement of a symptom that may suggest a certain remedy. And we must be very cautious as homeopaths not to allow this to prejudice or bias us in favor of the remedy suggested by questioning the patient along this line, and thus perhaps bias the patient in his replies. Okay, we know it sounds like it's going to be such and such a remedy, but if you question along this line at this point in this stage in the consultation, you might be tending the patient to move in a direction where he would not normally go. Number five, while you are dealing with one symptom, confine yourself to that symptom. Never skip from one symptom to another at random, as it confuses the patient and scatters the physician's ideas. This is a fascinating thought into the inquiry of the patient. So if you're talking about the eyes, then concentrate on finding out everything you can about the eyes as long as the patient is talking about this area of the body. Don't start questioning about some other part of the body or some other symptom that may have come into your mind as a homeopath. Just keep it focused, and this way you can delve even deeper into the person's sensations, their intuition, their feelings, anything that is related to that one symptom. Dr. Roberts says, now we will return to the necessity of rounding out the symptom picture in our record. Some symptoms may have been given with a fair degree of completeness. Others are very incomplete. We must complete as far as possible every symptom that has been presented. And for this, careful questioning is necessary. Each symptom must be rounded out as to time and place, the sensations, the kind of distress, the type of pain, all of the modalities connected with it, the probable causation, That is, what the patient thinks was the start of the trouble. Under the modalities, we must secure the aggravations and ameliorations, what makes things the symptom feel better or worse, of each individual symptom so far as possible. Not the least important is the emotional reaction of the patient. And every single week, every Wednesday, Dr. Adil stresses this point that he searches for what was the trigger, what was the emotional shock, reaction, response, that suppression, whatever it is, that might cause functional changes in the body. Dr. Herbert Roberts says, when we work out the recording of the case in this way, we cover all the parts of the man or woman and can see the picture as a whole. We must leave nothing uncovered. In order to do this, we may have to bring into play the testimony of the family or the nurse on symptoms or conditions that may have a bearing of considerable value. However, this source of information must always be scanned with a great deal of circumspection, and we must weigh the integrity of the source as being worthy of consideration. And as homeopaths, we not only speak to the patient directly, but we do get important information from family members, from caretakers, from the nurse, from their other physicians as to what has been going on in the person's life and how they respond in certain situations. And then Dr. Roberts tells us that we must be careful about what other people say because maybe they have a bias of some sort. And so take that with a grain of salt or, you know whether this person is being honest or is being objective in what they say to you about that individual. Dr. Roberts says, with the most careful recording and the most cautious questioning, we may be unable to find complete symptoms and may be unable to build up more than a sketch of the patient himself. We will deal with this in a later chapter of our readings and know that there are people who are so depressed and emotionally put into a situation that they have very little to say and cannot relate a lot of information. You might sit in the office for 22 minutes to an hour with only a few words spoken. And in this case, you don't have the complete information. Or if some people, when they fill out their intake form, they don't give complete information, you don't have a full case. In acute illnesses, take the acute symptoms, carefully record each one, and find out all there is to know about the patient, about the symptoms. Likewise, in the chronic picture, record all the symptoms as far back as you can dig out the symptoms and the sequence of the symptom pictures and prescribe for that state. So we're going to prescribe for the chronic picture if you're in that situation, because that means that there have been functional changes. In previous articles from Dr. Roberts, he explained that if a person is unable to throw off the acute symptoms, then they're moving toward chronic disease. However, he says, if you are dealing with an acute condition, limit yourself to dealing with the acute state alone and do not at the same time attempt to dip into what has been a chronic state. Acute manifestations show themselves with surprising clearness and to include chronic symptoms that have been manifest at other periods in time will be confusing the picture. So here he is very clear that if you have very clear symptoms showing in an acute situation, let's say it's an influenza that has gone through and the person now has very clear symptoms of restlessness, thirst for small drinks of water, going to the bathroom a lot, nausea, and you know that this is going to give you a very clear symptom picture to what remedy to select. But if you start throwing in older symptoms from chronic disease, it's going to muddy up your symptom picture. You want to look at specifically the patient who is sitting before you in the present time. Remember, we must prescribe for the totality of the symptom picture and not for any one symptom alone. but for the complete picture as it is presented in the individual. So he doesn't want to give us a one-sided case here. You don't want to look at one part of the body, only one organ. We want to see clearly these symptoms being reflected in the whole body. And what is the theme? What is the message that the individual is giving us? Dr. Roberts says, in an acute explosion, the chronic picture will retreat completely. Therefore, in treating the complete picture that is present, there will be no need to take the chronic picture into consideration. At the close of the acute attack, we again see the chronic picture. Then we will be the time to deal with it. In fact, there is no time in the history of the case when we can see the picture of the chronic underlying condition so plainly as at the end of an acute attack, after the acute conditions have subsided. Therefore, after dealing properly with the acute attack and waiting until it subsides, we will be in a position to see clearly the picture of the chronic case. This condition, following acute illness, is much more apt to be the manifestation of the chronic condition than it is to be the aftermath of acute conditions, as is properly supposed. That is very important to learn and know. Take the acute case, and once that clears, you're going to see open up before your eyes the chronic condition in all clarity. In considering the totality, we cannot overemphasize the necessity of getting the complete description of each symptom as to its location, character, and modalities. The modalities, the aggravations and ameliorations, what makes it better or worse, are the most important. Next in order come the character of the sensations. The most important symptoms, of course, are the general symptoms that pertain to the patient as a whole. Then come the aggravations and ameliorations. The mental symptoms rank very highly for the reason that they point to the man or woman, him or herself, and they may be classed under the generals to a marked degree. And we're learning today from many great homeopaths to look under the generals in the repertory that affect the entire being of that individual, and those are very important symptoms. The thorough examination of the patient from every possible angle should be carried through, not for the gross diagnostic symptoms, important as these may be from diagnostic and hygienic points of view. From the curative point of view, we should not fail to elicit all the possible clues that may lead us to the remedy. So don't leave anything out. Subjective and objective symptoms are to be elicited and recording. And those are the subjective and objective symptoms from the patient, him or herself. What is that patient feeling? What are the sensations? What are the emotional connection? What are the actual feelings that the person has? And what have they seen and observed? If it's a lump, is it, you know, is it hard? Is it movable? Is it red? Is it inflamed? They can tell you specifically what they are feeling. Sometimes this will require the utmost ingenuity for the homeopath to elicit the necessary intelligent replies without leading questions. So remember, leading questions are going to get you to a dead end, they're going to get you to a wrong remedy answer. The physician's degree of success in obtaining the proper symptom picture lies in his or her skill and patience. We cannot rush these patients through. We must be good listeners. Get the patient talking and tactfully keep him or her talking about the symptoms rather than wandering far afield. So you need to direct the discussion, but the way that the person is talking without leading the discussion. So you want to know about the eye, then find out everything you can about the eye. Then cultivate your powers of listening and give your powers of observation full sway to form the complete picture of the little details and habits of your patient. It has been said that criminal lawyers should be medical men. It is eminently necessary, however, that homeopathic physicians be past masters of the art of cross-examination and the observance of the patient's every movement and expression should be a matter of record. Thus, if you're sitting across from the patient and you see that they're constantly moving their legs very restlessly, agitatedly, if they're biting their jaws together, if they're grimacing, if they're winking, what is it that you observe? And these things usually occur during the patient's most stressful period in their discussion. So take note of that as you're writing down all of the symptoms. Dr. Roberts says, before leaving the case, go over again the family history, the personal history, the mental and physical symptoms. Consider the temperament, the habits, the occupation, the personality of the patient. Ask yourself if you have skipped anything. See that you have questioned every item, every function. Question the modalities in particular. Go over the previous drug treatments and consider that. Whoa, what if the person is on many drugs from the allopath? Could that be contributing factors to the symptoms that you're looking at? Know what the drugs and medications are possible of eliciting in a healthy individual. Remember that the nature and sensations of the symptoms, the time of day, the positions and circumstances under which symptoms appear are the most important modifiers of any given case. And I'm going to repeat that for the listeners. Remember that the nature and sensations of the symptoms, the time of day, the positions and circumstances under which symptoms appear are the most important modifiers of any given case. And so you're going to jot that down in your notes, whether the person is hungry at 11 in the morning, whether they are worse at from 3 to 5 in the afternoon, whether their symptoms, migraine headaches, progress from the time they wake up until sunset. Whatever it is, those modifiers are most important for you to be able to find the correct remedy and to look into the repertory and confirm in the Materia Medica. To clarify these general instructions, let us take up the matter in greater detail and go over together the following requirements. It looks like there's about 7 minutes left. I'm not sure I'm going to finish up today, but let's see how far we can get. In chronic work, it is necessary to take into consideration the general symptoms. By general symptoms, we mean those symptoms which pertain to the patient as a whole or to the complaint which he brings to us. In order to get a complete picture of the case as a whole, let us consider these elements: the aggravations, the periodicity, the seasonal aggravations, weather aggravations, whether it's the sun, the wind, cold, dry, wet, fog, humidity, etc., changes of weather as to cold to warm or warm to cold. You know, whether a person starts coughing when they walk into a warm room, whether a person feels better when they open the window. Changes of weather as before, during, or after storms, such as thunderstorms, rain, and snow, because we know we have remedies that are attuned to all of these weather changes. The tendency to develop certain conditions, such as the tendency to take a cold, to get a sore throat, to have a headache. The reactions to fresh air, such as craving for or aggravation from fresh air. Reactions to positions in rest or in action, such as if a person is worse when they're walking or better when they're lying down with the arms raised. These reactions in relation to position include also riding in trains, in cars, in vessels, or over in the sea, conditions of appetite, and the cravings or aversions of aggravations from certain foods. Does the person feel badly and get sick from eating seafood, from eating pasta, from eating dainties, from eating sweets? All of these things give us clues and help narrow down the remedy. The effects of vaccination or serum treatment. And each week, Dr. Adil always emphasizes that vaccinations can cause vaccinosis, side effects, and chronic disease. Reactions to bathing. effect of the altitude, the seashore, or the mountain. And we know we have remedies that are related to feels better at the ocean, feels better at the sea, needs, desires to go to the mountains. These are related to our miasms and hereditary tendencies. The amount of clothing that a person is required to wear. Does a person bundle up? Do they always wear a hat? Do they feel get a headache when wearing a hat? Do they have to wear a sweater? What about wearing socks to bed during the day and during the night? So are the symptoms worse or better during the day or during the night? The rapidity with which wounds heal. If the patient is subject to hemorrhages and bleeding, the reaction of the patient to the presence of others. Oh, that's an interesting one. How the person socializes, whether he prefers to be alone or in company, whether they are aggravated from being alone or in a group, an assembly, or do they need consolation? Are they better with consolation or worse with consolation? These sides, and also, lastly, which sides of the body are affected. And that's a long list of information that's going to be taken in with the case taking and can lead us to the best remedy. How about the thermic reactions of the patient? Is the patient hot or cold? In general or under varying conditions and circumstances? So just take note of the patient. If the patient's sitting before you in the room and you have the window open, do they ask for it to be closed? Do they start sweating? What is the situation? If there are variations of temperature, do they involve the whole or part of the body? And we know that in situations only if the person is having a fever, only parts of the body are sweating. Or is the whole body sweating? What about the child who has perspiration over their head, the back of their neck? What about the person who has sweating on their chest or under their axilla? Is the skin moist or dry? If he perspires, under what conditions? Freely or scantily? All over or only in certain parts? Is the perspiration offensive to the smell? Is it exhausting them? Is it greasy? Is it hot or is it cold? Is he better or worse during or after these situations and these conditions? How is the sweat related in time to the chill and the heat? So persons who have malaria, there are lists and lists of symptom pictures of the progression of the disease, the prodrome, and all of the different stages of disease. And how does the person feel with chills and heat during the perspiration? Is the chill or the heat partial or general? Is there shivering of a part or in general? And does this occur with or without chill? Is there thirst during the chill, during the heat, during the perspiration? In what relation of time to the heat, chill, or sweat? So be observant and see what the patient is asking for. Are they bundling up? Do they need 10 blankets on top of them to stay warm during this fever? Do they throw the covers off? What is their body position? What do they call for? Do they want some hot tea? Do they want ice cold water? Note should be made of the aversions and cravings, the type of sleep and dreams, the positions of the body in sleep, how the patient wakes from sleep, and his condition after waking. With either a man or a woman patient, the abnormalities of the sexual functions should be noted. Then the strange, rare, and peculiar symptoms should be sought out. And this was also repeated in Dr. Otto's talk earlier today, that when there was repression and suppression of the sexual functions in those who are in the convent, the nuns, the priests, those who have had certain reasons having sexual relationships, this can affect the entire body. This can affect functional and into pathological illness. It says that I have gone over our 1 hour. I will try to finish up in the last few minutes. I have left until the last mention of the essential parts of the case taking, the comprehension of the mental symptoms. To a great extent, these are symptoms that must be observed from the attitude. Another reason for leaving these until the last is that during the examination, you have probably been able to take the confidence of your patients to a greater degree, and they will give you more fully their confidence. So after such an hour or two or three of talking, now the patient has some trust in you. Find if they are subject to hallucinations or fixed ideas, especially any fears that are persistent. Take into consideration irritability, change of disposition. If you can unearth traits of jealousy, absent-mindedness, these must be seriously considered. Sadness, ailments arising from grief, vexation, sudden joy, all important factors. Is the patient over-insistent upon the minor details of life as to scrupulous cleanliness, or is the contrary true? Are they messy, or do they not care about cleanliness or sanitation? Your patient should readily reveal many of these most important things to you if you have been tactful and have secured his confidence. I refer you to a wonderful questionnaire compiled by Dr. Pierre Schmidt. This will assist you in securing the information you desire, and if you will study this carefully, it will prove a valuable guide in directing your questioning after the patient has finished telling you all he thought was necessary to your treatment of the case. It is well to reiterate the instruction. Do not interrupt your patient while he is telling all he knows about his case, except insofar as he may require guidance to keep him to the subject in hand. The physician's questioning comes afterward, and it is here that we must complete the picture of the case. What are the essentials to record in the case taking the case? The answer are the general symptoms, the modalities, the sensations, and the concomitants, what are happening simultaneously. Why should we have a written record of each case? The answer is so that we may review the case as a complete whole for our first prescription and for future reference, so that we may note the progress and development of the case. Why do we need to pay little attention to the chronic symptoms in taking the acute case? The answer is we take each case as completely as possible, for when an acute seizure is present, the chronic symptoms usually retire into the background, so that we need only prescribe for the totality as presented in the present time. When we do find the chronic symptoms portrayed, when do we find the chronic symptoms portrayed most clearly? Dr. Herbert Roberts says, at the end of an acute attack, the chronic symptoms usually show themselves clearly, even more clearly than at other times. The conditions following an acute attack are not the result of the acute attack, but because nature has cleared the patient to a greater or less degree by the acute explosion of the acute attack, this leaves a clear picture of the chronic condition. And this is the end of our marvelous two-hour show today, starting with Dr. Adil's tribute to Masters in Homeopathy and discussion about breast mass. Next Wednesday, we will continue part two with Dr. Adil Wednesday at 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. I will then continue with Dr. Herbert Roberts' discussion of taking the case, and his next chapter is going to be the analysis of the case. And I hope this has been educational and informative for you. We welcome so much your comments and questions, sharing these shows on Twitter, on Facebook, on StumbleUpon, on Reddit, on any other social network that you have, so more people can tune in and listen and learn. These are educational shows. If you have a medical problem, you must seek your healthcare provider. Thank you so, so much for listening. We will be on again tomorrow at noon Eastern Time with Alan Phillips talking about vaccinations and your rights in the United States. Every week we have tons of current events, news that is important for you to know and take care of your health. On Mondays we have the Health In Show, and hopefully Dr. Miranda Castro will be with us to talk about cell salts if she is back from her trip abroad, and we will show a banner on the front page of Homeopathy World Community for our upcoming shows. Please check them out there. Share our Homeopathy World Community Facebook page with your friends, and wishing you good health, lots of love, take care, exercise, and all those good things that you know we must do. Make it a routine. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you for listening to Heart Health and Homeopathy on Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio with homeopath Debbie Brock and Dr. Adil Chimthanawala Kasim, MD cardiologist. We encourage you to follow our show, click the reminder button to receive email notices when the show airs, and share with friends on Facebook and Twitter. Please send in your comments and questions, and we'll see you next time.